So thank you for inviting me to Santa Barbara. Unfortunately, I will only be here for a week. Well, luckily, it's the first week. And personally, I believe that this program, the first long-term program on the realistic investigation of correlated electronic systems, may turn out to be very important for the development of this field. It certainly comes at the right time, and most importantly, it brings together scientists from different backgrounds, and that is always good. So I think this workshop really has the potential for being something sort of a turning point in this field. Since this is the first talk, I decided, actually I had been asked, to give a very extended introduction. So my talk essentially consists of 2.1 parts, the long introduction, applications, and then a few questions. And I want to make clear that this dust is not on my transparencies, but comes from the glass screen here. Very new transparencies, okay, just for you. I want to discuss in the beginning the, not so much the quality as the difference or the potential of density functional theory or its approximations versus model approaches. Then want to move on to dynamical mean field theory, which is usually abbreviated by DMFT. So DMFT always means dynamical mean field theory. And since this rests, or the understanding of this rests a lot on single impurities and Anderson single impurity physics, I want to give a short crash course into that. And then discuss the fusion of conventional band theory in the LDA plus DMFT. Then in my second part, I want to show applications, results obtained in collaboration with Vladimir Anisimov's group. The simplest case being lanthanum titanate doped with strontium, because the simplest because it consists of degenerate T2G orbitals. That's methodologically the simplest case. Then the next complicated case where this degeneracy is lifted, but V2O3 itself, of course, is very interesting because it's sort of the classic example of a system with a metal insulated transition. And show to you how in the field of photoemission spectroscopy, there is a lot going on right now. So the last 4 weeks already brought changes again. Even more so in calcium strontium vanadate, because this spring 8 beamline in Japan, of which Professor Suga is the director, they are turning out now new results, high energy resolution results. I will not talk about our recent results on lithium vanadate because I don't have time. I want to discuss a little bit in the end how much LDA input is actually necessary for these simple systems. And then I will end with a few questions which I think should be addressed. And I would like to ask you to interrupt me. This is supposed to be a program, so it's not important that I go through all the material. It's more important that we discuss points, or at least if the discussion becomes too long, then we say we could go on in the afternoon or whatever. But I think it's important that the discussion sets in now. I think one of the main questions of the problems that we are dealing with, or try to understand, is ingrained in this picture. It shows photoemission data by Fujimori's group on lanthanum strontium titanate, doped with strontium. This is a strongly correlated metal, as is evidenced by thermodynamic measurements. And really, what we see is that this would be the prediction of LDA for the undoped material, which is a antiferromagnetic insulator, but LDA would predict it to be a metal. While in the experiment, we see this. It has more structure. In particular, there is this shoulder here, and there is this broad hump at minus 1.5 EV. I think that is also, I can already say, one of the riddles that have to be understood in virtually every transition metal oxide I know. There is this broad hump at minus 0.15 EV, very, very strange, although the U's are all different. And this is, of course, rather, this is a zoomed in. If we would go to lower energy, we would find all the oxygen. And if we would ask, show this to our colleagues in outside our field, they would say, what are you talking about? This is such a tiny effect. This is the thing you're spending your time on? Well, the answer is yes, this is what we spend our time on, mainly because metal physics is physics centered around the Fermi energy, and that we have to understand. And while already we know now that this shoulder is the residue, the remainder of the quasi-particle peak, and this is the lower Hubbert band, we know that now for quite a number of years, we need a theory that can yield that. That's very important.
Is that broad because of broadening put into it?
That is broadening put into it. That broadening of, that's 0.3 eV.
What are those points above the Fermi energy?
Excuse me? It is a, this here, I suppose it's a finite temperature effect. You mean this here?
Yes, is it this or what is it?
No.
How did you do the experiment then?
Excuse me?
It, inverse
photoemission? No. There is no inverse photoemission done on this. I think it's just the tail of the Fermi function at this room temperature.
No, it's an electron
volt. Excuse me?
Room temperature is a
40th
of an electron volt.
Maybe the background line cuts through that.
This I don't know. One would have to find this out.
So the thing is convolved with some resolution function.
Yeah.
And I think those are probably the 92 experiments where the resolution was relatively crude.
Like
but that structure at the Fermi energy, it's a real structure in the Gentzian states. It's not some resolution function effect or something.
You mean this?
No, the one at the Fermi energy.
This?
Yes, that shoulder. Is that real or is that?
That is real. That's why I'm talking here. That's the shoulder. The shoulder. Yes.
Do you actually measure ground state properties in this photoemission experiment? I thought NDA was a ground state property theory.
Yes.
But don't you measure excitations?
That is a deep point which I'm not going to address here. You're completely right. This is there are essentially two assumptions here that are made implicitly. First of all, that the energies, the Kuhn-Sham parameters are sort of the quasi-particle energies. Yes, but that is an assumption. And
so what you call NDA is the Kuhn-Sham spectrum.
Yes. So let's just list and compare the pluses, pros and cons of LDA. I'm only talking about LDA here and model approaches. Although this could also be, I suppose, GW. It is material specific, so that it's why it's referred to as ab initio, because it just takes E, H bar, M, and whatever. It, at least in LDA, it can be dealt with numerically rather well, but it has the disadvantage that for strong correlations, F electron system, it fails. That is well known. And here, the model approaches sort of complement this. The model approaches have the disadvantage that the input parameter, the hopping parameter, the U and the J's and whatever, they're unknown and they have to be taken from somewhere. They're computationally very expensive if you actually want to solve the many-body problem, but the advantage is that there is, over the decades, a systematic many-body approaches that can deal with strong correlations. So in a sense, these two approaches complement each other, and it was recognized early on that it would be very desirable to fuse these two to be able to actually investigate real materials with strong electronic correlations. And To do this, the two communities need each other really and must exploit the individual insight gained. Clearly the time has come where these communities have to stop yelling at each other. Well, I remember the workshop organized by you in Dresden a couple of years ago, when in Dresden at the Max Planck Institute, many of you know it, there is an aisle in the middle, and neatly separated on the left was the density functional community, on the right the models community, and sort of they were trying to make contact. Since then, a lot has changed. Now, how to include correlations in a realistic approach? This is not historically complete or correct, but correct it is, but it's not complete. Certainly, a very important approach is the LDA plus U by Anisimov, Zanon, and Anderson more than 10 years ago, which is very useful and helpful to understand systems with long range order, for example, magnetically ordered states. Why? I mean, this U is the U on a Hartree level. It is a static mean field theory. And we know that Hartree theory or Hartree-Fock can mimic correlations then when we have long range order. Long range order introduces a rigidity, and this rigidity may be viewed as correlations, although this is only mimicked correlations. Clearly, we know that to understand the many-body effects, we need to have a frequency dependence of the self-energy. And again, there's a big step. There have been other works too. I want to call that LDA plus U square of Matthew Steiner and collaborators in 92, eventually to LDA plus dynamical mean field theory, as put forward by Anisimov and Gabi, and simultaneously by Sasha. They called it LDA plus plus. I suppose because LDA plus U, and this was more, so it was LDA plus plus. Okay, C plus plus, fast, turbo. Okay. Of course, it doesn't have to be LDA. I suppose that's part of this workshop to find out how other input schemes can be used. For example, the GW approximation. There was a recent preprint by Antoine Georges and collaborators combining that with DMFT, etc. So this is, but there is also there are also different approaches. For example, to join density functional theory with multiband Goodswiller wave function, and exploiting the knowledge that we have of the Goodswiller approximation, and Werner Weber, who's here, I suppose he will talk about that at some time. So Bühnemann, Gebhardt, and Weber applied it to various systems, in particular transition metals.
There's also earlier work by Nitzheim trying to combine
Okay. So to drive at to what is dynamical mean field theory, let's just go back a step and talk about models approaches. The Hubbard model as the sort of the easing model for the electronic community, the simplest model, and historically the Hubbard's decoupling approximation leading to broad bands, the Hubbard bands above a certain critical U. And in a different approach, the variational approach, the Goodswiller, Brinkmann, Rice, giving sort of with the eyes of love interpreted in hindsight, giving a quasi-particle peak in the middle. And while the Hubbard approximation was too crude to get these delicate low temperature, low energy features, the Goodswiller, Brinkmann, Rice was not able to deal with charge excitations. And the question has been for a long time whether it's possible to find a thermodynamically consistent framework for that. And that was this was made possible in eventually by the dynamical mean field theory, which derives from the D infinity limit for a lattice system. Namely, in 89, Walter Metzner and I realized that taking a real lattice system, take the Hubbard model, then and take the limit of infinite dimensions or infinite coordination numbers, then the problem remains non-trivial but simplifies considerably. So in that limit, the self-energy becomes side-diagonal, the green function essentially side-diagonal, meaning that the most important property is this return amplitude to a site which lives in a bath of correlated fermions. So the dynamics is included because the omega is included here, but the spatial dependence is simplified. So that there was a lot of work on this, and it was soon realized that this is a single site problem in the sense of coherent potential approximation, and people, or myself included, connected with the single site aspect, in the sense that one has now a self-consistency problem where the propagator, the local propagator, is given by, because the sigma has no k dependence, is given by this expression. We can replace the k summation by integration over the non-interacting density of states. So this is just the non-interacting propagator in a shifted energy, namely with respect to this background. And the propagator itself can be taken from the textbook as a functional integral over e to the a, where this is a single site action, which is essentially the kinetic energy minus the potential energy. Kinetic energy is given by the inverse propagator. The potential energy is the energy on that site measured relative to the background. So this is the action. But a very important conceptual step was made by Antoine Georges and Gaby Kotlia, and also Mark Jarrell, who realized that this single site problem is in fact can be mapped to a single impurity problem, to an Anderson quantum mechanical impurity problem plus a self-consistency condition. That was important because now one could draw on an experience of several decades of research on single impurity models. And so there's a wealth of experience in dealing with these famous class of many body problems, and it's still, even today, the starting point for very important new developments. To explain a little bit the essence of the single Anderson problem, impurity Anderson problem, I want to give a short crash course into what to expect from a single impurity in a fermionic bath. So I have something elaborate here. I have to hold this because let's start with, let's say, a two-dimensional, it doesn't matter, a Hubbard model, the electrons hopping. It's just the kinetic energy. It's just a band we get for the density of states, a non-structured band. Now we put at some site an additional orbital, let's say here. We call these D electrons. These are C conduction electrons. These are D electrons. There's no interaction, so there is just one additional peak on top of this broadband. They don't communicate with each other. If they start to communicate, because we allow for a hybridization, namely we allow them to quantum mechanically mix, then the situation changes, because now by golden rule, we see that this is not an eigenstate anymore, but it can decay. So there is a width now proportional to V square, the hybridization, over the bandwidth. If we now, in addition, switch on an interaction on this orbital.
Yeah, this is wonderful. It's old-fashioned PowerPoint.
Old-fashioned. So, if we now introduce an interaction on this site with U, then suddenly, well, first of all, we get two more peaks. These correspond, I've drawn them sort of symmetrically here. These are the peaks due to charge fluctuations on that site. while here, this peak here is no longer, has no longer width v square, but is exponentially small. This is, this would be the Abrikosov of Sewell resonance. And so we see here a characteristic three-peak structure whose physics is very well understood. And this can also be seen here, for example, in this paper by Georges and Cotelier in 92. We see here, this is the Luttinger liquid pinning, because we have a single impurity here, so this is pinned. And here we see the side bands developing. And we will see again and again this appearance of a structure with a quasi-particle peak, namely here, in difference to, I should make a few comments here. This is now the result from a many-body model, namely the Hubbard model, mapped to a single impurity problem with self-consistency. One should sort of course, the three-peak structure is there too, but one should not call that a condo peak, because we here only have one kind of electron. There's no hybridization between conduction and F electrons on where it's just one mess, so to speak. And so one should call that, that is the quasi-particle peak. These can be called still the lower and the upper Hubbard band. I'm saying this because I gave this talk a couple of years ago, and a famous experimentalist came to me and said, "Well, Vollhardt, what are you so excited about? I mean, there's nothing new since Gunnarsson Schönhammer." I said, "Pardon me?" He said, "Well, you show a condo peak, you show it's all, we understood that 20 years ago." It was very hard to explain that, and this is partly because theorists understand the difference between a condo peak for a single impurity problem and a quasi-particle peak when it's only an effective single impurity model, but plus self-consistency. I think it's quite important. I should say this three-peak structure is very general. It's linked to the physics. I remember you and Bulut and White, less than 10, but more than 7 years ago, I guess, you calculated for the two-dimensional Hubbard model. It's the same. Of course, it has to be the same.
The thing I remember there was that for the two-dimensional Hubbard model, it seemed that you formed the upper and lower Hubbard band, but that when you didn't dope and kept it half-filled, you found no peak in there.
Well, that is...
When
that,
you dope, the peak appears
you're right.
Lower
you're right.
edge because of the difference of...
That's right. That's right. This here is for half filling. I'm sort of talking more generally now about the doped case. In the doped case, you have the quasi-particle. Otherwise, you would have, well, you would have.
I think that the important difference is the degree of frustration. I think that if one studies the two-dimensional, very frustrated case, which unfortunately has the minus sign problem, so it's hard to get at it, it will be probably one will see this kind of three-peak structure.
Yeah.
So that's.
I think the absence of it is once you establish the long ranging thermodynamic work,
right,
knock that out.
Right.
Yeah. And then when you dope, it seems to appear lower edge. Which always is a puzzle, it seems to me, when you look at the angle result photo emission data, particularly for the lamp construction copper oxide, where it would appear that the chemical potential is not making that shift, and therefore you have stripes or you have prism, you have something going on that's different. A simple homogeneous Hubbard model.
Well, certainly already.
I don't know if you guys agree with that. Right? Something strange is happening, or something different is happening there.
Sure, in a frustrated system, still it doesn't have symmetry.
Yeah, because, well, we put it deep right.
It appears just at the edge of the local world. Uh-huh. So it seems to be symmetric.
I should also say that the additional self-consistency is very important. One understood single impurity models very well, but one never expected a phase transition, for example. There was no need to expect a phase transition in single impurity models, at least at that time. And also the finite temperature effects were not so very important. Here, this is different. The self-consistency brings into the information, namely, that one is dealing with a lattice system. This is not a strict single impurity. This is a lattice system which is mapped onto an effective single impurity model, and the lattice information is coming in from the self-consistency. So now one can have phase transitions. One can have also, actually, the Mott transition. One can have long-range order in all this. And one can have non-trivial physics at finite temperatures. So to wrap up again, take a microscopic lattice model where the local, the Hubbard interaction is important. Then, applying the DMFT, the dynamical mean field theory, one comes up with, and one can explain that. One does not need to, but it is helpful and has shown to be helpful to that this is equivalent to an effective single impurity Anderson problem plus self-consistency. Because of that mapping, the k-dependence of the self-energy is missing. This is called a local theory. And so apparently, if we apply the results of that to a finite dimensional system, this will be an approximation. Yeah? But the of course, this is an approximation then. On the other hand, if we are interested in features close to the Mott-Hubbard transition, for example, we know that the frequency dependence is more important. It doesn't say that the k-dependence is unimportant. It's just so that when one is interested in features where the renormalization or the change due to correlation effects, the omega dependence is important, then this is a particularly good approach. If one is interested in features like high TCs, one wants to explain photoemission data at high TCs, where the k-dependence is very important, then one shouldn't apply this. So the problem now in merging the LDA and models approaches via the DMFT, the problem is due to the different approaches, and there is a setup here, already mentioned, for LDA plus many-body theory, in the following way. Start with the LDA in the LMTO formulation, with here the generalized hopping matrix elements, the local energies, etc. Add to it the local correlations, which are the most important. Certainly numerically they are very important. It doesn't mean that non-local correlations are not important, but at the moment one wants to get at least the main point, namely the local correlations. And then one is faced with a problem that that some of the interactions is certainly already in the LDA, so that would be called double counting. That's a misnomer because there is nothing to count here. There's no diagrams or whatever. Yeah. So one has to subtract something, and that is an approximate way. That is something I, at least in the beginning, was very worried about. I will show you that at least in the examples that we treated, it's not so important, because if you have, for example, degenerate bands, then it's just a shift of the chemical potential. But one has to worry about that, and that is something that's a future issue, how to deal with that. One can estimate that by the successes of LDA for molecules, for example, taking the atomic limit, and can estimate the average correlation energy, and then subtract this from the total LDA energy coming from here, take, in the spirit of density functional theory, the derivative with respect to the densities of the interacting orbitals, and this gives us a new energy, epsilon with superscript zero, where the interaction has been subtracted. If we then replace this energy, where the interactions were still contained, by that, where they're subtracted, we get an ab initio Hamiltonian, where this is sort of the LDA input, and here is the correlation part, where these are the sort of the direct exchange and contributions. This is the Hubbard U, for example. This is the density interactions between spins in different orbitals. This is Hund's rule coupling, etc. And with this ab initio Hamiltonian, one can then, I should perhaps answer my question. Check the U equal to zero limit. What happens, simple thing, if we put U equal to zero, the interactions equal to zero? That's an interesting question. What comes out then? In fact, we should get back to LDA somehow, right? I asked my doctoral student, Georg Keller, to do that, and jumping far ahead, I show you results for V203 for the A1G orbital, which This is the LDA input for the A1G orbital, showing this typical sort of bonding, anti-bonding feature here. And this is the QMC result, put at equal to zero. And here, similar for the EG pi. If we now broaden, this is obtained by a maximum entropy. If we now broaden this.
One clarification.
Yes.
If you take the U equal to zero, the problem of looking at it in the Hamiltonian form, this is okay for the spectra, so this
yes.
is completely right. But if you want to compute the total energy, you have a problem because the total, if you take the expectation value of the Hamiltonian that you wrote down, you will not get the LDA total energy. Because there are all the other terms besides the single particle term in the Clanchan Hamiltonian.
I see.
And it, because of that.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
We
yes.
later corrected that by formulating, giving to this a functional formulation, which allows not just to get the spectra, but also the total energy. You would like that when you said U equal to zero in your formalism, you get the LDA total energy, which we know it's already quite good. If you just look
yeah.
at the Clanchan Hamiltonian, you will not.
Okay, okay. But I think for the spectra, it's fine. So if we apply the broadening, which is usually there, here it's rather large already, 0.3 eV, as in the case of this lanthanum titanate, you see that essentially you get the LDA spectra again. So it's not so bad. Yes, please.
Just because I don't know much about this field, but one of the nice things about density functional theory is that it's based on theorems and that you can actually prove things about it. I know the LDA is an approximation and in practice it's very approximate, but the way you presented your LDA plus DMFT, I wasn't quite clear whether there are similar theorems you can write down. No, it's just a kind of a Hamiltonian you write down and
yes.
hope.
Yeah.
I'm still a little bit confused by this because in your Hamiltonian you subtracted out this LDA correlation energy.
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't expect the quantum Monte Carlo at U equals zero. It should be mapping onto the LDA with the epsilon zeros, not the true energies, because you've subtracted out this correlation energy.
Yes.
I'm just confused as to exactly what it's a different Hamiltonian at U equals zero.
Why?
I mean, isn't it? I mean.
The double counting also goes to zero when
yeah.
it goes to zero.
Double counting is proportional to zero.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was it subtract the average U part, not of the A?
So the same U parameter that you're using
right.
in
right.
the Hamiltonian
exactly.
is multiplying the energy.
The double counting. Right.
Right.
Because you're trying
right.
to take out the average energy within LDA.
Yeah. Okay, so the strategy is then this, starting from such an ab initio Hamiltonian, the DMFT will map this to a, this time, multi-band single impurity Anders model plus self-consistency. And in general, one would now have to calculate the propagator with all these site indices and the quantum numbers L and M from that, now in Cape representation, LDA zero Hamiltonian, with here the self-energy that would be sort of the proper complete way to do. In simpler cases, namely where one has no symmetry breaking, so one doesn't have to take into account all these indices here, sort of in the paramagnetic case, and in particular if the partially filled bands are well separated, then often a simpler treatment is quite sufficient in the sense, then we can use the Hilbert transform. Then we can do, as I showed in one of the previous slides, namely get this propagator, which now does not depend on any of these numbers anymore, from the LDA DOS as from the correlated bands. So this would be then one equation that gives the lattice aspect to it, and then still the hard part here, the single impurity part, this functional integral has to be performed. That is what is so time-consuming. So with this, one gets a possible fusion of LDA and models approaches here in the DMFT, and it is often called now LDA plus DMFT, as I mentioned before.
So the only place where LDA enters is the density of states.
In this approach, yes.
In this last.
Yes, state. Correct.
In the right hand side,
In the left hand side, it's different. Yes. Yes. So these equations have to be solved. These are very complicated self-consistency equations. They have to be solved by a technique. At the moment we are not in the position to say it doesn't matter which technique we use. For example, iterated perturbation theory is an approximate method, non-crossing approximation, quantum Monte Carlo. And I think that to find a fast, effective single impurity solve at low temperatures is very important, because only then can you understand how much has to be corrected on this side. One has to be sure on the methodological side here. We are working on the NRG. The generalization to two, degeneracy two, has been successful, but three is not doable even at the moment because there are too many states. The flow equation approach from Wegener, which was really refined by Kehrein in the last couple of years, I think has great potential. In fact, I expect that within 1 year it will be possible to have the first essentially analytic solution of a DMFT problem in the Kondo lattice problem. So at this moment, there exists already a number of applications of that. I will talk about results in my collaboration with Vladimir Anisimov. But of course, there are many other results. There's the work by Sascha Lichtenstein on iron and nickel and strontium ruthenates. And there is volume collapse at the alpha gamma delta transition, at gamma transition in this case, by McMahon, Held, and others. There is the work on the delta phase in plutonium by Gabi and collaborators. Even sort of surprisingly, perhaps quasi one-dimensional organic conductors by Antoine Georges, and this will be discussed at this workshop, I'm sure. So this is essentially the end of the first half, which took 40 minutes, plus, did someone take the time? discussions. So I now want to present some results for various transition metal oxides obtained by quantum Monte Carlo solutions. And first of all, I want to start with the simplest system, this lanthanum strontium titanate. Simplest again, to make sure why this is simple. This is essentially a perfect cubic perovskite, and so it's a D1 system. Cubic crystal field gives this characteristic splitting that we know from the transition metal oxides, threefold degeneracy here in the T2G, one electron, and if we put in strontium more than 5%, this becomes a correlated paramagnetic metal. LDA gives the typical result for the early transition metal oxides, namely it gives here I concentrate only on the T2G because the EG is empty. This gives a broad quasi-particle peak, so this is a metal. Even without doping with strontium, while at low temperatures, we know that this is an antiferromagnetic insulator. If to put the density, the dynamic mean field theory on top, we have to think about the U that we use, and I think that is an important part, namely. When we started this business, our collaborators from the LDA community gave us a value of U which was, I don't know, let's say, 4.125. And this was the value. This was sort of the value. It turned out that there is no the value. I had to learn that because it depends on the wave functions and the choice of the orbitals. And over a weekend, Igor Nekrasov, by doing three different kinds of choices of orbitals, got various U values for that system ranging from 3.5 to 5 or something like this. So I think at this moment, this is perhaps one of the most important things to be developed. This is to my LDA or density functional theory colleagues. Is it possible to find sort of the best possible, the optimized LDA value for these parameters? Before we think about you shake your head. Okay, that is an answer already. But I think there is, at the moment, still room for improvement. Before we talk about self-consistent joinings and the DMFT coupling back to the LDA, etc., I think it is very important. I don't know whether I have time to come back, but I had an example last week. 3 weeks ago, I was in Krakow at the SCES. I talked about V203, and George Savatsky was there, and Andrei Olesh. And they said, the J value calculated by LDA is about 0.9, let's say, 0.9. And it's usually argued it's not much affected by screening, so 0.9 is a good value. But using the Rucker parameters, one finds a much lower J. I think Werner Weber will agree with that, because in this 3D series essentially increases linearly, and with cobalt and nickel, I think it's largest. But with vanadium, it would be perhaps something like 0.6. But LDA tells us it's 0.9. So this is an interesting question. Can already also LDA give us a J value that is more to the real value? Then also the question, how about the U values? I think this is an important question.
What do you call the real value?
Yeah. Excuse me?
What do you call the real value?
I mean, the real value I call that George Savatsky gives me.
In the moment, the U, or the J, is a well-defined concept in terms, let's say, of the many-body wave function.
Yes.
Then we can go ahead and construct functionals for it, which can then be evaluated from the density obtained from LDA or something.
Right.
But my impression is that it is not really a terribly sharply defined concept.
Okay.
This is intrinsic.
First, Doug. Doug was first.
Do you have any better chance of putting the LDA together to give perhaps the hopping parameters that are going to come in, and somehow using quantum chemical calculations to go after U and J? Or does it involve the same problem? Once you do the quantum chemistry, you've included some of the local correlations that maybe shouldn't, that you're going to pick up later, so there's a subtraction. But it does seem to me, for some of the cuprates, there's a picture where you can use local quantum chemical calculations to get at the U and the J, and mix this somehow with band calculations to get at the band structure. Is that considered too many cooks stewing the soup?
Well, you get some U, some J.
Yeah, it seems to me like you're sort of hinging it on a model Hamiltonian that you don't, as Matthew said, it's not actually derived from anything. So, in some sense, it's a generical idea to talk about there being a U. In any case, they usually be screened out. And,
it's a real problem that you're going from a continuum picture, an LDA one, to a kind of an orbital picture. It's
sure.
Kind of confusing.
Yeah. David, you.
Yes, the U, I mean, if you would do a Hartree-Fock calculation for the ion, it's some high number, about 20 volts.
Yes.
And then you are, I mean, in LDA, there is some screening, there are some correlations in LDA, and it comes down to 4 volts. Mm. So, I mean, the screening effects are very big.
Yes.
And you are trying to decide what U to use now in the on-site model. And really, it's just depending on how much screening you want to remove from the LDA or how much is in the LDA. And it's a sort of an ambiguous question, because you don't really know what is in the LDA.
Yeah.
So I don't think there is a, I think this scheme of trying to find some LDA way to calculate U, it's always going to suffer from these kind of ambiguities, and it's not going to be easy to get rid of them.
I would like to come back to what Hardy said. I mean, U is not an exact concept. It's certainly a useful notion. And I think that everybody who worked in the field of strongly correlated materials knows that we need that notion. But if the word exists, I think it's like an approximate concept. One can try to make it very precise, but when you start making it precise, then it will depend on the method you're using, etc. Just to give you a concrete example of what I mean, iron and nickel. So to be concrete, if you do a plain LDA plus U calculation and you want to get some of the physics of iron and nickel right, then one needs to use a set of values of U. Then if you want to do a DMFT plus LDA calculation for the same iron and nickel, then you need different values of U, because you're using really different functionals. So given that the functional is different, it's not surprising that the input parameter that you have to put in there is different. But it's something which has to be thought of. First, how to make it precise. I think that we would gain a lot by formulating this concept better, because the reality is orbital dependent, it's frequency dependent,
energy dependent.
But it's clear that it's already, as a first approximation, is definitely useful in describing correlated materials, and without it, we don't get the physics right, certainly not in systems like mod insulators or systems which are nearby. So it's an open problem, I think, for the workshop
yes.
to try to advance
right.
on that issue.
Right.
And it certainly depends on what you calculate. Even for the old superconductors, as you know, there was a mu and a mu star. The mu star wasn't smaller than mu because of screening. It was smaller than mu because you cut off the frequencies over which you were going to do the rest of the calculation, so it got renormalized.
Right.
So again, depends very much
right.
on how much of band you include, how
right.
much of the frequency, how much of the momentum.
That's a very insightful comment, and the way to try to put these concepts in a firm framework is really thinking renormalization group, where the parameters that we use to describe the physics are scale dependent, depend on the scale that one is studying the problem. I think the technology that has been developed around DMFT can help to do that, because there are natural RGs which are connected with treating impurity models, so
yellow
clusters.
Hmm. Yeah.
I have a simple
yes.
question. Is that value of your LDA obtained from the LDA calculation of the 6% doping system or the undoped system?
This is for the undoped system.
Undoped system. But you are going to calculate the electronic structure for 6% doping.
Yeah.
How do you?
Well, my colleagues tell me since the LDA already predicts for zero doping a good metal, although it's an underfermenting insulator, these 6% don't change much.
The U value. Screening, I expect that the U value can also change.
I suppose that is true, but I suppose in LDA it cannot be done, because you would have to do a gigantic supercell calculation.
Yeah.
So it's done for the undoped system.
What is the present situation of the LDA plus DMFT for undoped system for London titanium?
For the undoped system, it hasn't been calculated down to the low temperatures to get the antiferromagnetic phase.
It shows formation of upper and lower.
Well, this is. Okay, so Masa, this is, thank you for the cue. So the LDA plus DMFT results obtained by quantum Monte Carlo at relatively high temperatures, 1000 K, get now this, give this red curve, and here again is this three-peak structure. It's a three-peak structure because we have degenerate bands. We have the lower Hubbard band, we have the upper Hubbard band, we have the quasi-particle peak. Observe the pinning here.
Yeah, but my question is, what happens if you do that for x.0?
This calculation was done for 0.0, x.06.
Yes, 0.06.
Yes.
And what happens if you do the same thing for an undoped system? That phase particle disappears where it remains.
At this temperature, not much would change.
Yeah, that's okay. But at that temperature, what happens for an undoped system?
I'm saying not much changes because you're at so high temperatures, and there is no antiferromagnetic order at this temperature.
No, it strongly depends on U. If you put larger U, you'll get insulator.
Okay.
Even for this temperature.
That is clear. Of course, then if you U large enough, then the quasi-particle peak goes away. That's true. So we see that this, well...
Quasi-particle peak should always be there in the doped case.
Excuse me?
Quasi-particle peak should always be there in the doped case.
No, what we were talking about, if you tune up U. Then,
right. But the gap is 0.2 electron volts for the system, so at 1,000 Kelvin, we still expect some insulating in reality. There's no experiments, but the size of the gap is 0.2 electron volts.
Yes.
So it might be
2,000 kilo.
2,000 kilo. Yeah.
So probably larger U might be better for these materials, so as to get the top in the bottom insulator and have feeling. That's what.
Yes.
Yes.
Sure.
UV will produce the gap.
The aim here was to sort of explain the features of the experiment.
It's interesting to extend that work to the direction of yttrium titanium, because in that case, yttrium titanium has a large gap because of small bandwidth. And you can see in systematics how the gap closes to the direction of 1.28.
Okay.
Yeah.
But if you would turn up U to 6 volts to get the gap, then wouldn't the satellite be in the wrong position in the spectrum?
I guess so, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, let me show you the result then. The value of, we chose, what was it, 5.50 was chosen. It is within this uncertainty of the LDA, of that value. So we chose 5.0 and multiply with a Fermi function, use this 0.3 smoothing, and then we see that where this feature actually comes from. This is what is left of the quasi-particle peak, and this is the lower Hubbert band. If you would choose differently, then this agreement would not be as good. This is at least our earliest result. This was just to see. U is used as a fitting parameter. It, of course, there's guidance by LDA that says that it is around somewhere, but I don't know, it could be from 3.5 to 5, so that's not very helpful. So we know it's not 0.5, we know it's not 10, but we chose 5.0 because then this agreement here is best. So this is not, the U is not somehow calculated, or so it is chosen, it is essentially here as a free parameter.
Three orbitals in
T2G
bands equally occupied, or?
Yes. Yes. Yes, they are. Now, it is now 5 to 11. Well, I just go on until... I want to show some new results on V203. Because this also documents the ongoing activity in experiment. So, just to recall, V203 has been of interest for a long time because this phase diagram shows there's a transition between a paramagnetic insulator and a paramagnetic metal. So, there is no symmetry change, there's only a slight jump in the C over A ratio. And so, since the symmetry doesn't change, it wouldn't be necessary to be of first order, that transition. So the question is this first orderedness a consequence of the electronic correlations or not? And um, Well, I don't really want to go into the details. It was long recognized that this red line, this transition, should be a consequence of the electronic correlation. So there were models approaches by the one-band Hubbard model, because it was known from the theoretical work that there's a metal-insulated transition, so it was applied. On the other hand, there was a more material-specific input that takes into account the complicated structure. In addition to the usual splitting, namely in this vanadium, we have a trigonal splitting, trigonal distortion, that splits this further into an EG pi and A1G orbital. This is doubly degenerate, this is singly degenerate.
Yes, please. Crossovers, I think there's also a second crossover, which is like a continuation of the first order line, which is a very important feature of the experiment and dynamical material theory. So besides the crossover region, you can also continue that first order line straight.
This.
Yes. And that's basically where the coherence disappears.
Okay. Okay. I wanted to drive at this concave shape here.
Yeah.
So this structure was even today, last night, I came into the office. I got a long mail from George Savatsky about the importance of VV pairs, and immediately replied by Jim Allen. I couldn't even read it all. And so there's ongoing interest in V203 and the importance of pairs. And I hope we will clarify that, because Sascha Lichtenstein and Sascha Potayev are working on that. And it is because in the structure there are VV pairs, they're certainly important. And so if we take these neighboring pairs, we have here in the Castellani pair, they propose the following, that when you have a bonding and antibonding state, and they're very largely separated, so because this is so low, two of the electrons from either V goes into this bonding state. And because this is so low in energy here, it forms an inert magnetic state, leaving effectively a single spin on per vanadium. This was the Castellani picture. And hence, this seemed to justify the fact that one could use the model, a Hubbard model, a one-band Hubbard model, with spin a half.
Two-band
Hubbard model. I agree. But it was done, I mean, V203 was often investigated by a one-band Hubbard model for a spin a half.
But Castellani wanted to have a two-band.
Of course, because he knows very well the system, of course. All I want to say is that, I mean, this is, of course, an effective spin a half two-fold degeneracy model, but this was
taken... to be wrong, but...
Which happens to be wrong, right? Okay, but it was taken as a support to start with a spin a half one-band model.
The idea was a qualitative idea. I mean, that what Castellani, now everybody picks on that work, but there was really a very important work, because it's the first time that the concept of frustration in the system emerged clearly. I mean, and the idea of the paper is that basically the system is very frustrated, so it doesn't know whether it's ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic, and therefore the important concept is frustration. So the one-band model is just trying to capture the very high temperature part of the phase diagram with the idea that frustration is important. It's sort of
absolutely
just some simple toy model.
Absolutely.
Frustration.
A paper or an idea or proposition that dominated the field for 20 or 25 years must have been a very deep and useful one. There can be no doubt. And since Gabi already mentioned that, I think the model side is clear. The model can give general aspects of correlated fermions, the shape of this transition line, this concave shape, the first orderedness, etc. But if one wants to understand, for example, the spectrum, then one has to take into account the material aspects. And it wasn't long ago, namely only 2 years ago, when a paper that took, I think, two years to be published, by George Savatsky, Jim Allen, Suga's group from the Spring 8 high energy beamline in Japan. They did polarized X-ray spectroscopy experiments, and in short, they could only explain their results by using an S equal to 1 state instead of a spin a half model. And there was a lot of theoretical work in the antiferromagnetic phase, which I'm not going to talk about. I want to apply to the paramagnetic phase, which is the most difficult because we have no long range order. So again, the LDA input for this scheme. Here is again the orbital scheme. So we start here with the structure, the structural data for the insulating case, namely the chromium doped case. And then LDA gives us the following results. Here is, for, in black, is this A1G, which I showed. It has these maxima at the zone edges, so with a very good justification, one can say that these are the bonding and antibonding states of Castellani. One has to be a little careful, but when this is apparent that this looks like this. This is sort of a quasi one-dimensional subsystem here. And if we compare this with the data obtained for the LDA result for the structure of the metallic case, the pure V2O3, then we see that there is almost no difference, except that in the metallic bandwidth is slightly larger than this one. Okay, and so now we introduce the electronic correlations, but what U value to take? We know that from LDA that the U is of the order of 5 or something like this, but here we have to be more specific because we have a metal insulated transition, and we take that knowledge and sort of are bound to win by trying to find that U value about. Where the insulating structure gives an insulator and the metallic structure gives a metal. This is not the case at 4.5. In this case, both structures give a metal. This is not the case at 5.5. Both structures give an insulator. So at about 5.0, without trying to be too precise, the insulating structure becomes sort of insulating here, goes really low here, while the metallic structure is more metallic. So we take 5.0 as that value of close to the transition, at the transition, that triggers the transition. And here, this was an interesting information last week, as I said, that the Rucker parameters would actually give a 0.6. And we are just studying just to see how much that changes. This changes these peaks, the positions of these peaks. So, again, multiplying with the Fermi function, etc., we published that result. Here, were data from in-house by Siegfried Horn's group, which were known to be surface sensitive, and this was the 5.0 result from LDA plus DMFT with QMC. And this is sort of a satisfactory result in the sense that here's this shoulder, again, the residue of the quasi-particle peak here, the lower Hubbert band very flat. And this is sort of okay. But we knew already that, as I say, the results were surface sensitive. At the surface, of course, I should probably explain that because that's, again, an important point. The correlation is here parameterized in the simplest way by U over the bandwidth. At a surface, U is less screened, so this is larger. The W is smaller, and so altogether U over W is larger at the surface, so at a surface-sensitive result should appear more correlated than a bulk result. And in fact, that is correct. A couple of months later, not only Siegfried Horn, but also Jim Allen's group produced these Jim Allen, Suga, and Sekiyama produced new results here. This is below the Fermi surface. These green ones are now, were now the ones with high resolution, showing this is much peakier than the data we showed before. We also we had also calculated for the excess that is above the Fermi surface and compare this with again the in-house data here, showing quite nicely the these two peaks. This is the A1G and this is the EG pi, showing while at low at below the Fermi surface you could still interpret this as a result of a one band model. You clearly see that at least you need two bands here because you have A1G and you have the EG pi. We did not include the EG sigma, which would be higher up, but there would be somewhere here, and we check that now already. This is the remainder of the quasar particle peak, and we can already tell the experimentalists, look at, I mean, these data are taken from a gigantic background in excess, but clearly, if there's a quasar particle on the left side, there must be a quasar particle remainder on the right-hand side, and we can tell already the experimentalists, look out for that part. In your subtraction, you have ignored that, you have lost it. Where is it? So we, at the same time, it took a full year, went to lower temperatures. The results I showed you were for 1,100K. So Georg Keller, in his thesis, which is going to be completed soon, first went to 700K. That was still doable. 300K took a long time. And what you see here, the effect of the temperature is that the quasar particle peak goes higher. Of course, this we know in principle, but how actually it's done, it was not known. And suddenly, this result is now very peaky. This was the old result, which we compared with the data, and now we got very peaky results, and we were worried. We're too peaky. Then, about 5 weeks ago, I got another mail from Jim Allen. They also got more peaky. Namely, they now subtracted the OJ contribution from their photo emission, and that is sort of the final result at the moment. Below the Fermi surface, these are the best available data by the high energy beamline from Jim Allen and Suga et al. These are the lowest temperature experiment theory from us by at 300K, and from now on our results can only go down, so to speak, in peakiness, because if one included fluctuations, etc., this would have to go down. But it shouldn't be the attempt to get perfect agreement here. Here, this is at 300K for the states above the Fermi surface. Again, the quasar particle peak is much more pronounced, not seen in the experiments, but this must be an artifact of their subtraction. So I want to finish with that and just say that one can also calculate the spin state. After all, we got in this business because in the Park et al. Data, they were interpreted as a spin 1 system. And indeed, this is also borne out by this calculation. Namely, if one calculates the high temperature susceptibility, the square moment here, one finds that this above U equal to 3 saturates at 4. Since this is a square, it means there are two particles in it, meaning that this is spin equal to 1 state, which is distributed over both these orbitals. So indeed, V203 is a spin 1 system. And that essentially finishes that story. And at this point, I would like to just very shortly discuss how much LDA input actually do we need. Please remember, perhaps I should show this, but you remember that the LDA input is very structured. Something like this. When we turn on the correlations, then because of the correlations, imaginary part, etc., our results are very smooth. What does that tell us? The question is how much, at least for the, how much material specific input is required. And so this is what we are checking at the moment. Perhaps just a few parameters are needed. Of course, we need the material specific aspect. Because if you start with a Hubbard ellipse, you essentially get the same results, because the close to the metal insulated transition, everything is dominated by this three or four or whatever peak structure. But and you get that independent of your input. But of course, the material specific aspect has to come in somewhere. The question is where. Now, we begin to understand this, that for the simplest system of degenerate bands, like in lanthanum titanate, where we have this splitting, where the T2G band has this structure, we essentially need only the bandwidth to get contact with experiment. So from the LDA density of states, we just need the second moment. For non-degenerate bands, where we have trigonal splitting, like in V203, we also need the centers of gravity. So we need the centers of gravity, the first moment, certainly the second moment, and perhaps because these are strongly asymmetric, we need also the third moment, meaning here we just need one parameter as material-specific input. Here we would need something four or six. In the general case, of course, where we have, let's say, like in sodium vanadate, where we have very different bond strengths, and this goes beyond this simple LDA DOS input thing, and we would have to use the Hamiltonian approach. So I think that we will test that. It does not require the complete LDA spectrum, which is approximate anyway, but only very reduced set of parameters.
Probably depends what you want to calculate.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Probably it's enough.
Yeah, that, I'm. You're right. You're right.
Also, yeah. those moments are essentially just the nearest neighbor hopping in LDA.
Yes.
I mean, the second moment requires only the nearest neighbor hopping. So
yes.
It's like saying you can try everything except locally for the LDA calculation as well, because somehow the correlations smooth it out. That's interesting because LDA guidance
say that wouldn't work, but they are, I guess, more precise. They like the short bits of the density states.
Well, it depends what you're interested in.
Yeah. If you're interested in the spectrum to compare with angle-integrated photo emission, then probably a simple description of the bands is best.
Yeah.
But if you are interested in something that is very close to the Fermi energy, then probably you need to worry a little bit more. Because things are sharper.
Yes.
And you can't.
At the end, I want to present some puzzles which were created during the last 2 weeks. Perhaps this is also interesting because this also reflects the ongoing changes in the experimental situation. And I can give you no answers, so that's perhaps the most interesting part. And this is the and it's our Japanese colleagues who brought us these problems in quotation marks, because in this $1 billion high energy electron beamline, one can now do high energy resolution experiments. And let's talk about the substitution series strontium to calcium vanadate. When you replace strontium by calcium, calcium is a little smaller, I think, at the ion. It distorts, the system distorts. While in the strontium system, this VOV bond is just a straight line. In the calcium system, this has some kind of an angle. And we just learned it's 160 degrees. It's amazing, but calcium vanadate, which is such a that does not exist published data on the structure. So Igor Nekrasov in Vladimir Anisimov's group calculated with old data from Yekaterinburg and only found out last week that actually these were sort of outdated, but couldn't find it because Inoue has it in his desk. So we now have the data. But it was sort of understood. This is a particularly simple system. It's a cubic perovskite, it's a D1 system, it's a Mott-Hubbard system. We should understand the system really well. Okay? We know that thermodynamic and transport quantities are almost independent of whether you have strontium or calcium. So, but on the other hand, the photo emission data were quite different. For the strontium, it is like this. And the interesting thing is that these are all the available data until 4 weeks ago. Even the high-resolution data of Morikawa et al. Yeah, they are not markedly different from the ones shown before. These were indicated as surface sensitive. These were high resolution. No big difference. So the strontium looks like this, and the calcium looks much more correlated, as you see here. This is a flat part. This looks close to an insulator. This is sort of strange. This was strange because strontium, because of the thermodynamic data. And so, on the other hand, on the basis of this and the different angle of the VOV, it was sort of expected that the calcium system is more strongly correlated. And then 4 weeks ago came these results by Suga's group, Sekiyama et al., showing that if one increased the energy of the beam, then suddenly this quasi-particle peak really goes up and up and up and up. Strontium vanadate, yeah? And for calcium, just the same. Actually, we can put them on top of each other, I guess. And see that while the old data were very different, the new data are hard to distinguish. Actually, I put the AND components into one slide here. It's like this. Okay? So we see now that the calcium is slightly more correlated than the strontium, but this is really a cosine theta effect. The bandwidth or the hopping is smaller in the calcium because of this angle. The bandwidth is smaller. It's just a cosine theta effect. Yeah? We will check that now, but I sort of don't have any doubt. But the question to me is really, why, if you take these surface sensitive results, why is the calcium much more correlated at the surface than the strontium compound? And why is the calcium compound at the surface much more strongly correlated than in the bulk? Now, of course, you can say, well, of course, it should be more correlated. But LDA colleagues, Vladimir Anisimov, just sent me an email yesterday that he cannot understand it. Because the strand, one can calculate what the effect at the surface is. The T2G band is only very slightly 6% narrower. It's the EG band that is strongly affected, but that's empty. So it shouldn't play any role. The U is not much affected because at the surface you have 5 oxygens, in the bulk you have 6. So it's not clear what's happening at the system. And the question is, are we close enough to a metal insulated transition so that small changes in U actually do make a big difference? But
I'd like to offer one suggestion.
Yes.
It has to do with the structural aspects of those materials. At the surface of this kind of perovskite, often the tilt angles are larger. There's a greater tendency towards this tilting instability that gives the PNNA space group at the surfaces than there is in the bulk. And that's seen in a number of perovskite systems, that the tilt angles in the bulk are smaller than the ones on the surface. And there's a recent case in this strontium ruthenate superconductor of that playing a role. There was some work by Matzdorf using STM showing that even though in the bulk there's no rotation, in the surface there is.
I see. That's very interesting. You're saying in the calcium compound, which already in the bulk has a tilting, this tilting could be stronger at the surface, and hence that's an interesting point.
Yeah.
And in principle, those things can be addressed by density functional calculations. Yes. I mean, now it should be fairly standard to do a surface calculation for both the yttrium, for both the calcium and the strontium compound, and see if this is true. It's not so difficult to see surface reconstruction, right?
Somebody should do it.
It's possible.
Or maybe somebody should do an experiment.
Yes.
Experimentally, does the result depend on which surface?
Yes, very much so. There's a difference between fractured and scraped surfaces. Suga's experiments I showed are for fractured surfaces, very good surfaces. He gets back the old results for scraped surfaces. So yes, it is surface dependent. Yes?
Just a question about these. It was already observed in my IG stasis that there is a strong energy dependence for the emission spectrum.
Yes.
How much, and then in my IG and Dasama tried to make a deconvolution between the surface and the bulk signal. So how does that compare to the bulk signal they were actually extracting from their experiment?
Well, I think it doesn't. I mean, they found, I think, good agreement with the old experimental results.
No. They concluded from their study that the quasi-particle, the weight in the quasi-particle peak that you would guess from just the raw data, say the low energy data, was actually a lot bigger once you looked at the deconvoluted spectrum. So they also concluded that the system was a lot less correlated than what you would have guessed by looking at the raw data.
You mean in the bulk?
Sure, in the bulk. I'm talking about the bulk.
Yeah, so what is the question?
If you just look at the 21 eV data, you're right to conclude that the quasi-particle weight is really tiny, it's very, very small.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that was a puzzle for many reasons.
Right.
Okay. Then if you try to deconvolute the bulk and the surface along the line of Mighty and Asama, you find for the bulk spectrum something which is a lot less correlated with a lot more weight in the quasi-particle peak, which goes, along the same lines as this thing. But I'm just asking for a comparison between this spectra and the bulk spectra obtained after the convolution in Mighty's work. Yeah, that's all.
This I don't know. I just got these a week ago. Yes, please have a look. So that's I want to finish here. It's what else can I say? I mean, okay, just to wrap up. So I think for systems that are strongly correlated, that are close to the Mott metal insulated transition, the LDA plus DMFT is the only method that can get these features. And it depends at the moment crucially on the input from band structure theory. So there are these questions which we discussed already. Can the LDA input be improved, or is that not a well-defined question? Is there a fast and reliable impurity solver at low T? Because I think it is important that one does the best on the numerical side so one can understand what is wrong on the physical side. And this may be an unimportant thing, but we have these clumsy expressions, LDA plus DMFT, sometimes even in brackets QMC. And a famous colleague at a German-Japanese conference 2 weeks ago, he knew about this for a couple of years. It was not possible for him to repeat these acronyms. So I think we need something shorter. I mean, these acronyms were, I think, invented to impress our LDA friends that we also can come up with very complicated acronyms. But in the long run, it will not help much. We have to find a suitable acronym for the input plus the DMFT. This is a small point, but this is not a completely unimportant point. We don't constantly want to run around with LDU plus DMFT, and then someone says, DMFT, isn't that the density matrix renormalization group? You know, things like that. So I don't know. I mean, a suggestion would be something to have something like realistic DM. Now, we shouldn't, I don't know. It shouldn't be too long, you know. Usually, acronyms should not be longer than three. I have no real sort of, the R would correspond to something realistic. I don't know. Discuss that at your workshop. Thank you very much. Thank you.
On the experimental side, do they see now temperature dependence of the photoemission spectra?
That hasn't been done yet. They can go. This was actually done at 20K, so this was the lowest temperature they can reach.
Are you talking about the latest data?
Yes.
On vanadium oxide. Yes. Because it seems to be that the crucial test. I mean, I don't care so much at this. I mean, at this stage, I don't care so much about the full quantitative agreement. Yeah. But yeah. I still think that it's important to see if we have the gross qualitative features.
Yes.
And just looking a little bit from the distance, it seems to me that the qualitative feature is the temperature dependence of this quasi-particle beam. So either the experiment sees that, and then I think that then we can talk about how to improve U's and J's and all that to get the thing, or it doesn't, in which case I think that we should start extending the DMFT towards clusters. And it's a qualitative but well-posed question that experimentally should be.
Absolutely. And I think the Spring 8 beamline can do that because they can go from 20K to room temperature. But they wanted to do their very best, go to the lowest temperature available. But you're right.
And that's why it's particularly important for VCO3, because there we know we have close demand transition of these extensions.
Right. Jim?
In your presentation, you concentrated mainly on these single particle properties of photoemission. But of course, certainly on vanadium oxide, a whole bunch of other things have been measured, including just simple things like susceptibility or transport and so forth. Do you have plans on trying to calculate any of these other kinds of quantities?
Yes, this is part of a doctoral thesis to calculate the optical conductivity, and I hope it. I wanted to get these results 2 years ago, but they didn't, because they, with Niels Blume, whom you also had correspondence with, because of general problems, how to define that on a generalized lattice and whatever. Yes, please.
I want to go back a little bit to the question of LDA plus 2 unleading value.
Yes.
By asking a somewhat different question, which is, if we are in a situation where the material is not so strongly correlated, is it possible for first principles to compute Fermi-Liquid light quantities, namely quasi-particle weight, lifetime, and other Fermi-Liquid parameters?
There
was don't take you as an adjustable parameter.
Yes. I would like to pass this question on to experts in that field.
You can calculate it from GW, for example. You can calculate lifetimes and lambda parameters, yes.
But is this the problem? But for weakly parameters, yes.
And the U. But it is with the U that comes out from this.
No, U
at all.
Yeah.
The thing is, in weak decoded systems, you don't usually have such sharply defined orbitals. The whole idea of the U comes next easily.
But that's it. And how small would the U compared with the bandwidth in the cases where you were able to compare experiment and theory? Was U like 1/10 of the bandwidth? Or what happened when U is a quarter of the bandwidth?
Masa.
Aside from some uncertainty.
Excuse me?
Aside from some uncertainty for the determination of U.
Yes.
If you do the self-consistent group of LDA and DMFT, may I understand that there's some general trend that the gap or correlation effect is slightly underestimated?
You mean that LDA plus DMFT themselves are self-consistently linked? Or you mean the self-consistency cycle of the DMFT?
DMFT and LDA by using charge density.
Well,
we never did that system, but so I expect that will improve some of the things in the sense that will reduce a little bit the bare matrix elements of the hybridization. Yeah. I expect that, but it has to be done.
Yeah.
So the general trend has not been done.
No, I mean, right. So far, to my knowledge, the only system which has been done so consistently is plutonium. And now I think iron and nickel.
Yeah, in case of lanthanum titanate, if you choose U the value of 3 or 4, then yes. The gap seems to be a bit smaller than expected. So, if you do the self-constant loop by using the charge density function, then do you expect that the U becomes larger?
We don't know, but it has to be done. There's not much experience on that we could sort of base our assumptions on, I think. Yes, please.
Since we know that in many cases LDA alone gives really qualitatively wrong result, it seems like a bad starting point. Maybe a better way of going about it is to use a better functional or construct a better functional in the context of density functional theory, which somehow includes the physics of the Hubble cube. So
yes.
I'm wondering, in your self-consistent, and since the exact exchange correlation function can be, for example, represented in terms of the exact sigma, the exact self energy, can one represent the result for sigma that you would get from a self-consistent solution of your equations? Can one represent that in terms of a set of diagrams? Then one could plug into the expression for EXE of DFT.
I don't know. Perhaps you will know in December. Any more questions? No. Okay, thank you.